The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. This week's Future Proof is a special on the really, really big questions. I think, therefore, I think I am. Prepare to have your mind blown. Later in the show, we'll be discussing the idea of free will with Robert Sapolsky, and Mark Whitman will be telling us how altered states of consciousness can change our entire perception of time. You can contact the show. It's science@newstalk.com. We're on Twitter @NewstalkScience. Or you can text us for 30 cent 53106.
Now, I think it's partly because my spirit animal is a Pikachu and my favourite three movies are The Matrix, The Manchurian Candidate and The Truman Show. But I just am fascinated with how reality is constructed inside our brain. And I was thrilled to find out that our next speaker was available to chat to us. His name is Donald Hoffman. He's a cognitive scientist and author of Visual Intelligence, How We Create What We See. He joins me now. Donald, if we get through this chat, just nailing one single idea, I'll be really excited. And that's the idea that evolutionarily, it is more beneficial to see things as they are not than as they are. Let's sort of unpack that idea firstly and talk about how our brain uses shortcuts to make sense of the world. And maybe we might start off talking about things we visually see.
Right. So most of my colleagues in the cognitive neurosciences who study perception agree that our brains construct what we see. That, for example, the images at the eye are only two-dimensional, but we see a three-dimensional world. So we have to construct the shapes and colors and objects and motions that we see. Mm. But most of my colleagues also believe that evolution shaped us so that our constructions are in fact true reconstructions of certain true facts about the world that we need to survive. So no one thinks that we see all of reality as it is, but most of my colleagues would agree that we see those aspects of reality, that we reconstruct those aspects of reality that we need to survive.
And give me an example of that.
Well, so for example, they'll say that, you know, to avoid falling off a cliff, you need to accurately reconstruct the true shape of the, of the geometry of the cliff so that you'll know exactly how to walk so you don't fall off of it.
Hmm.
So there really is a three-dimensional world with objects and colors and motions and shapes, and our visual systems and our sensory systems more generally estimate the true properties of that world. And when we estimate the truth, then we're in a position, they think, to act in a way that will enhance our survival. So they think, in short, that accurate perceptions make us more fit.
Yeah, that seems on the surface of it to make sense, because when we think about how we navigate the world, we imagine that things are there, they're not in our mind. And also we imagine that the better we see things, and the better we perceive them, the more accurate our vision of the world, the better we can navigate.
That's a normal intuition. It's one that I shared. But I decided about 10 years ago to really look into evolution, evolutionary game theory in particular, which models mathematically what we mean by natural selection. And I wanted to ask, first in simulations and then in a theorem, do our senses, if they're shaped by natural selection, do they get shaped to see reality as it is? Again, not all of reality, but some aspect of reality. And what I found in simulations and then working with a mathematician, Chetan Prakash, in a theorem, is that to the extent that our senses are shaped by natural selection, the probability is zero that any aspect of our senses, you know, any aspect of the language of our senses is even the right language to describe reality. So it's not just that we get this or that aspect of reality wrong. It's that the very language of space and time and colors and objects and shapes is just the wrong language to describe objective reality.
Okay, so let's just pause there for a second, because there's a lot that you've sort of gone through, and I want to help people navigate through it, because it's a crazy idea. So if we imagine that human beings, if we imagine that human beings, say, 100,000 years ago, that they could only see in black and white, and then 50,000 years ago they could see in three colors, and then today they see in perfect color, we would imagine that being able to see more of the world would actually be really useful for us. But your modeling has shown us that actually if we see the world as it is in terms of physics, that we're less fit to survive in that world than if we make up a world and create illusions around us for us to navigate it more quickly.
That's exactly right. That's what follows from the equations of evolution by natural selection. And I think that it could help people to think about a metaphor that's helped me in understanding this. And that's what I call the desktop metaphor. So on your computer, you know, suppose you're writing an email, and the icon for, say, the email that you're writing to your friend Joe is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your screen. Does that mean that the email itself in your computer is blue and rectangular and in the middle of your computer? Well, of course not. Anybody who thought that misunderstands the point of the desktop interface. It's not there to show you the truth of the computer, the diodes and resistors and voltages and magnetic fields. It's there to hide that. And if you had to toggle voltages to craft an email, your friends would never hear from you. And so we can see from the desktop interface metaphor that it's useful to have essentially eye candy on your desktop that lets you control the truth, all the complexity of the computer, while you're completely ignorant about the nature of that truth. And that's what evolution has done for us. Three-dimensional space, as you perceive it around you, is just a three-dimensional desktop. And physical objects are just icons in that desktop. And we were shaped by evolution not to see the truth, but to have a desktop interface that hides the truth and just gives us the eye candy representation of fitness payoffs that we need to survive. Think of it as like a video game in which you're going around and chasing after points, trying to get to the next level of the game. That's what we've done. We're chasing after fitness points, and we don't get to the next level of the game, but our offspring, you know, having offspring is the equivalent of getting to the next level of the game. And that's what the evolutionary game is about, chasing fitness points. And if you're chasing truth, it turns out you're not doing the right thing and you're less fit.
And if we work this out in our mind, if we opened our eyes to see everything, and we've talked on this program about attentional focus, where the brain zeroes in on a certain part so that we get rid of the noise around us. If our eyes allowed everything in, all the information that came in, everything that came into our entire eye at all depths and at all frequencies, so we could see ultraviolet and infrared and X-ray, then we would be lost. And so we have gotten this hack to just see the colors in the visible spectrum so that we can navigate more quickly through the maze of the jungle, the Sahara, wherever we are, right? That's the idea, that actually we have less information, but that information is more useful for us to get to the prize.
Absolutely. And one of the selection pressures is to do things as cheaply as possible. We need to spend as many calories and do as much computation on perception as is necessary to get the fitness information we need to survive, but we don't want to spend any more time or energy on it, because every calorie you spend on perception is you have to go out, kill something and eat it to get that calorie. And so there are selection pressures for our sensory systems to be as cheap as possible to allow us to survive in our niche. And so it's not only that we don't see the truth, it's that the interface that we have, which is hiding the truth, is as brief and as compact as possible to save energy.
And these sort of shortcuts are all around us. And you have a great example of beetles sort of working with a very short amount of information to get what they need, but sometimes that backfires.
That's right. So there's a beetle in the outback of Australia called the jewel beetle, and it's dimpled, glossy, and brown. And the males fly, the females are flightless. And the males fly around looking for a female, and when he finds one, he alights and mates. But it turns out that in the outback, there are also Homo sapiens who like certain kinds of beer that they call stubbies. The bottles are called stubbies, and they're also dimpled, glossy, and brown. And when guys started throwing these out into the outback, the jewel beetle males found them far more interesting than the real females. They tried to mate, and the species almost went extinct. And what this shows is that the jewel beetle had successfully mated for hundreds of thousands of years. You might think that the males know what a female really is, and the answer is apparently not. They had just a simple trick or hack, a heuristic, which said, you know, effectively, a female is anything dimpled, glossy, and brown. The bigger, the better. And that trick worked in their niche until their niche got disturbed by these, you know, beer bottles. And then all of a sudden, that trick no longer worked. And the species would have gone extinct if it weren't for the fact that they changed the bottles. And that's what evolution does. It gives you just the simple tricks and hacks you need to stay alive in your niche. It doesn't show you the truth.
Do we have good examples of these sort of shortcuts that we get around the reality to just live our lives more efficiently?
Well, one example is something that is called supernormal stimuli. These are things that we find even more interesting and attractive than reality. And one example of that is makeup. So when someone puts, a woman puts a bright red lipstick on, they're making their lips a color that would never appear in nature. But if it's done properly, it can be more attractive than anything that actually appears in nature. And that's once again because our visual systems have these simple tricks and hacks and shortcuts that we use to decide what's attractive and what's not. And so makeup is effectively exploiting the fact that this is a fallible process that we built in, finding out what is attractive and exploiting that.
What you're saying is that it is possible that none of the things that we see actually physically exist in and of themselves, like the table I'm sitting at. It's useful for me to imagine that this table is here, but actually we've no real evidence that it is here except through human perception.
That's right. I'm saying that the table is your experience of a table is not, you're not perceiving a true representation of a table that really is out there that would exist even if no one was looking. Instead, a table is a data structure that your sensory system, your visual system, constructs to represent fitness payoffs and how to get them. And so every object is something that you create on the fly. It's a data structure you create on the fly to represent how to get fitness payoffs. And as soon as you look somewhere else, you garbage collect. You destroy that data structure and you create a new one. I look over here and I see a fork. And now I look over there and I see a cup. I created the fork, then I destroyed it. I create the cup data structure and then I destroy it as I look away. I'm just trying to very, very cheaply create the minimal data structures I need in this moment to get the fitness payoffs I need in for my next action. And as soon as I'm done with that, I destroy that and create another one.
Well, I mean, you don't just mean see, because you could walk backwards and your bum will still hit the wall. But this is an idea that I had when I was, I'm sure many people did themselves as a child. It was one of the things that I really wondered about as a child is, how do I know that anyone exists other than myself? Actually, if you know my personality, you probably wouldn't be surprised to learn that that's something I was thinking about when I was 8 years old. But I was really thinking, you know, how do I know that I'm not just creating this world as I turn around? I mean, there's no way to test for that.
That's right. And the extreme version of that is called solipsism, which claims that the only thing that exists is me and my perceptions. Solipsism is certainly a philosophical position one can take, and it can't be disproven. I myself don't take it. I think that there is an objective reality that exists whether or not I perceive it. It's just that it's not spatial or temporal. It doesn't consist of objects in space and time. It's something else.
Huh? Like what?
Well, of course, the right answer is I don't know. But as a scientist, what I try to do is to make precise proposals. And so I'm proposing that instead of the universe consisting of unconscious space, time, and matter, I'm proposing that it's a vast social network of what I call conscious agents. So there's this infinite network of conscious agents. That's what's fundamental. And then my task is to show that I can use the dynamics of that network to boot up space and time and physical objects as a user interface that's used by some agents to interact with that vast network. So I'm working on a theory of consciousness in which consciousness is fundamental and space, time, and matter are derivatives. They're just desktop interfaces to this vast network.
So if we put all of our senses together, the physical world around us seems very real. So if I look at the apple, I get visual representation. If I touch it, I know it's real. I can smell it. It exists across various spectra. If we look at it with an X-ray, we can see what's inside it. Can we ever say that apple definitely exists, or are you questioning the nature of its existence at all?
Yes, I'm saying that there is no apple at all, that it's only a data structure that we create, and we create it not to represent a true apple that's out there, but just as a solution to a computational problem. How do we represent fitness payoffs in a way that we can easily get the fitness points we need to stay alive? So physical objects, as we perceive them, are not approximations to the truth out there. They are abstract data structures that we create to just let us reap fitness payoffs. We can see this with people who have synesthesia.
So I think that's really interesting, the idea that you can actually physically feel things that aren't there, and that works fine. Yes. But then if Aiden were to come into the studio, he'd be able to feel the same table as I. And that's where subjective perception breaks down in a way, because he's not making that table up, because we both feel the same thing, don't we?
Well, what's interesting in that case is that because Aiden's interface is very, very similar to mine, we will both agree about the nature of the constructions that we're making. I'll say, yes, I'm perceiving a three-dimensional table, and Aiden will say the same thing. But for example, if I show you an illusion called the Necker cube, it's a line drawing of a cube on a flat piece of paper, but everybody sees it pop out of the paper in three dimensions. And so I can look at this flat piece of paper and say, oh, I see a cube there. And Aiden would say, oh yeah, I see a cube there too. But in fact, there is no cube. The reason we agree that there's a cube is because we are both creating the same abstract data structures.
Using the same stimulus.
Exactly right. So there is an objective reality, but it's not in space and time. It's not a cube. It's not a table. It's something utterly different from that. I'm proposing it's a network of a social network of conscious agents. But whatever it might be, it's not in space and time. And we then have our species-specific way of constructing fitness representations, and we come up with things like tables and cubes and so forth. And because we're members of the same species, we agree. If I was, you know, dealing with a pit viper, maybe we wouldn't agree.
Well, I hope you stuck with it, because that was tricky stuff. But if we wanted you to come away with this idea, which I hope you have, that in order to get to where we need to go, we create a world that helps us navigate it. And actually seeing the world as it is more accurately is not as useful as seeing it less accurately and doing these sort of hacks to get to the nut at the end of the maze. Really interesting speaking with you, Donald Hoffman, cognitive scientist and author of Visual Intelligence, How We Create What We See. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, is the idea of free will just an illusion?
Now, does free will exist? It might be a pretty big philosophical question, but it's also one that occupies the minds of neurobiologists. One such is Robert Sapolsky. He's professor of biology, neurology, and neurological sciences at Stanford, and is the author of Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst. Welcome to the program, Robert. If you wouldn't mind maybe starting off with this idea of free will, has it been under question from a biological point of view for long?
Well, it's a pretty new addition to the free will debate. It's gotten there a couple of thousand years after philosophers started with it. Huh. But it's basically been a central, if often unstated, issue in the neurobiology behavior for the last century or so, because more and more what we learn are ways in which biology regulates our behavior. And with enough of these insights accruing, after a while, free will begins to seem like kind of a suspect concept.
So let's talk about how we behave and how a decision to act happens in the brain first, and then we can maybe dig a little bit deeper into free will. So when I decide to pick up my pen and throw it at my producer, what are the things that go on in my brain that make me do that?
Well, it turns out to really understand where any behavior like that is coming from, you obviously have to know what the brain is up to 1 second before neurons have sent a command to your muscles to fling that pen. Hmm. But what you then need to also do is ask, well, what sensory stimuli in my world in the last seconds to minutes triggered those neurons to do that. And then you need to ask, well, what hormones in my bloodstream in the hours to days ago made my brain more or less sensitive to those stimuli? And then you're asking, well, what changes in my brain, what neuroplasticity has occurred in the previous weeks to months? And before you know it, you're considering what your adolescence had to do with how your cortex was constructed. And then it's back to childhood and fetal effects on your genes and then genes themselves. And then questions like, what kind of culture did your ancestors invent centuries ago that influenced how you were raised? And then all the way back to having to think about why our species evolved the way it did millions of years ago. And when you look at all of these biological influences, over and over, what you keep seeing are ways in which influences on our behavior occur where we never used to have a clue this was pertinent. And over we say, oh, I had no idea biology had something to do with that. And this notion of free will just keeps getting boxed into tighter and tighter spaces.
It sounds like you're saying I was sort of predestined before I was even born to assault my producer.
I suspect an awful lot of culture and upbringing and what you had for breakfast today and what socks you put on and what your blood glucose levels are, etc., had a lot to do with it as well. But certainly influences coming before that had something to do with it.
So talk to us about this, because from reading your writing, I got the impression that you were sort of fighting back against the sort of genes are what determine us. Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, sort of in some way implied the selfish person as well, and that these genes sort of told us this is wrote the code for who we are and essentially told us who we are. I thought you were going to say, well, you know, we do have some sense of free will, but it seems like you're saying we are just software running on hardware.
Yes, basically. You're absolutely right in picking up a certain skepticism, not about whether genes have something to do with our behavior, but whether genes have a lot to do with our behavior. And
right.
This being the genomics era, there's a certain amount of hysteria and excitement about it. And sort of my world is filled with sort of molecular fundamentalists who believe that genes explain everything, and they explain some of what's going on, but what genes do varies by environment, and thus gene-environment interactions are much more interesting. But when you put that together with evolutionary influences and cultural influences and all the way up to blood sugar levels 30 seconds ago, you are left with a picture of not a whole lot of genetic determinism, but absolutely a picture of biological determinism.
So I sort of take some comfort in this recent science, having had conversations with researchers over some amount of time. When I have done something and I screw something up, maybe it's a bit of work, maybe I make a fool of myself on stage or on air, I have found a way to find some solace in the fact that I couldn't have behaved any other way. Is that how you look at our decision-making, that the idea of punishing yourself for behaving in a certain way, in a certain circumstance, is pointless because your biology compels you to do so?
Well, that's a wonderfully subtle key point, which is, how do we view our own behaviors and how do we view the behaviors of those around us? Those around us, it's absolutely imperative that we recognize we're biological creatures, and thus be really, really cautious and careful before you decide why somebody has done the behavior that they've done, especially if it's a behavior that you judge harshly. And I think a big consequence of our current understanding of biology is it's got to question the entire criminal justice system.
Yeah.
In terms of how we think about our own behaviors, that winds up being a much tougher one. Because, on a certain level, if it's going to be hard to convince people to think it was just biology making sense of any horrible murderous act, It's just biology. When somebody comes up to you and says, hey, good broadcast you had today. Whoa, thank you. No, actually, no. It's because I was born under these conditions. I have these genes and I had this upbringing. And so on. The whole notion that we're not only biological organisms when it comes to making sense of our worst, most destructive behaviors, the fact that it accounts for our best ones as well. I'm convinced psychologically the latter is a much, much tougher one for people to grasp.
Yeah, the idea that they're just saying they like the program because they were compelled to do so and they have no free will over that makes me really upset, because I actually tweeted about this recently saying, what a kind thing for people to do. But I guess if I'm letting myself off the hook for throwing my pencil at my producer, then I suppose I must also then not accept kindness from strangers because they had no choice. So is that a pretty radical view in the area of neurobiology, that we are software running on hardware? Because as you say, I mean, it would, if the entire world accepted this, both religious and non-religious, but particularly in the justice system, the world would be a very different place if we were being fair about it all.
Yes, it would. Among neurobiologists who think really hard about it, most of us wind up having the stance that I do, which is what the philosophers would call hard determinism, which is there's no room for free will in there. A certain percentage would be soft determinists, which is what most of the reasonable sort of sane philosophers seem to reach these days, saying that, well, yeah, there's lots of realms in which biology influences us, but there's still somehow room for a little man up there in our brains who ultimately makes the decisions and pushes the buttons at the control panel. But among the rest of the world, people are very attached to the notion of free will. And when those include judges and lawyers and jurors, that produces some really outdated conclusions. In the United States, at least, the legal sort of standard for deciding, oh, it was not him, it was his disease, organic impairment, that's a major mitigating factor in criminal behavior, is based on a case in the years 1840. And it hasn't absorbed any new neuroscience since then.
So I would love to imagine a world where we accepted that people were a product of their environment. But, you know, it's very difficult for the victim of a crime sometimes perhaps to accept this idea of the world. But it's an idea. I don't believe that if someone is physically well, in other words, hasn't had a brain injury, is loved and cared for, that they would end up doing the sort of crimes that we read about in the papers. But I wanted to ask you about this term social plasticity. If we believe that free will doesn't exist, what is social plasticity and where does it fit?
It's just part of the story. Behavior is what the sum of the biological influences on you produces that's overt out there. And some of the time, behavior produces things on the level of multiple organisms that begin to count as these things we call groups and societies and society values, and which are just as much a manifestation of all of this as the rest. And so insofar as the brain can change, that neural plasticity stuff, behavior can change as well. And group behavior and societal plasticity must exist as well. And we certainly see examples of this. In the 18th century, the scariest people in Europe were the Swedes. They spent the entire century rampaging through Europe, and Sweden is now coming up on 200 years since it's had a war. Their society changed. And we certainly know lots of other examples. It's as malleable, which is to say it's not infinitely malleable, but it's often more malleable than one would think. It's as malleable as any other behavioral manifestation of our biology winds up being.
I wanted to ask you about where this takes us, because if we have sort of evolved to have these behaviors, and society has evolved to be more tolerant, more cooperative, and presumably less violent,
How does that sort of extend into the future? Because this is something that you discuss in the book. You kind of talk about where society is going. I mean, sometimes you look out the window and you think, good God, are we going backwards? But overall, it seems that as a society, we're evolving to a much more harmonious place. What do you see as the end point of that?
Well, in the last 400 years or so, what we in the West have learned is if somebody has an epileptic seizure, it's not because they're demonically possessed. It's not because they've made a bargain with Satan. You shouldn't burn them at the stake. Oh, it's a biological disorder. And we think completely differently about that these days. We're maybe 150 years into thinking differently about sort of the biological disorder we call schizophrenia. We're maybe 50 years into thinking that way about kids who have trouble learning to read, not because they're lazy, not because they're unmotivated, but because they've got micro malformations in their cortex that we now call dyslexia. All that's going to happen is we're going to learn more and more of that stuff. And what that has to do is make us pretty humble when we come to judging people, because almost certainly we know that in the future, people as concerned and cautious and wise as us, but with a larger information base, are going to look back at us and say, my God, the harm they did then by the things they didn't know yet.
Mm. I suppose it's quite a depressing, at the same time, quite optimistic view of looking at the world, although the idea that the world will become less judgy seems to be sort of a weak argument if you look at what happens on social media these days. But really interesting book that kind of goes into philosophy, biology, neurology, and how we make decisions. It's called The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst. Robert Sapolsky, author, thank you very much for joining us.
Great, thank you.
Coming up, why does time seem to stand still when you're flying through the windscreen of a car?
If you've ever been unfortunate to be in a car crash or a near-death experience, how has your perception of time changed? Because it's a common report that people, when they're flying through the air with bits of glass all around them as they're thrown to the pavement, can remember logos, remember what they had for lunch, and seem to recall all manner of intense detail in the brief second that they're in the air before, crash, they hit the ground. Is this real? And how does our perception of time change in extreme environments? Well, Mark Whitman is research fellow at the Institute for Frontier Areas in Psychology and Mental Health in Freiburg. He's also author of Altered States of Consciousness: Experience Out of Time and Self. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Mark. How are you?
Hello, I'm good.
It sounds quite a trippy book. And actually, in some ways, I suppose it is, because you do deal with drugs and its effect on our sense of time. But tell us a little bit about what is the book about? What are you trying to explore?
Yeah, so I'm interested in consciousness research. And so one, I think, very efficient way to understand what consciousness is, self-consciousness, is to go to, let's say, frontier areas of non-ordinary waking state consciousness, where things dramatically change.
Right.
And if we understand these really interesting changes phenomenologically, so from your introspection, from what happens in the brain while you're having these experiences, we will learn a lot about consciousness. We might even be able then to understand this, what we call miracle of consciousness. And that's why I'm doing this research.
So when you say extreme forms of consciousness, what do you mean?
Yeah, so you mentioned this case of slow motion effect. People have an accident. I also had this once in a near car crash.
Oh, did you?
I talk to a lot of people who, after my talks, they come to me and say, oh, I also had this with a bike accident. Even my father once, because he knows what I'm working on, told me, while he was tripping, falling down, he's an elderly man now, falling down, he, onto the ground, just falling onto the ground, because he stumbled, he had this slow motion effect. So it is actually quite common.
Mm.
How you may explain this is that you are in some sort of fight and flight mode, because it could be a very damaging situation, a car crash, or if you're in a fight, what your body has to do is being in a totally alert mode and totally quick. quick and responsive. So your inner organism, the processes speed up, and then relative to this inner speeding up, the outer world slows down. And that would be one explanation of why we have this slow motion effect, because then you can react quicker, and relative to your quicker reaction to the environment, the outer world slows down.
What other extreme environments do we see an altered state of time perception?
I mean, what people from the 1960s and 70s, of course, know is sort of like psychedelic-induced states, yeah, which you can get through magic mushrooms, through LSD nowadays. Also, there's a cult surrounding this with a drug like ayahuasca, where you get into very strong altered states of consciousness where you lose your sense of self and time. So this is the topic of my book. In all these, and we can talk about other areas where of altered states of consciousness, where time and self changes dramatically. And I want to understand why do these belong together, self and time, and I can give some explanations. And let's say since the 1990s or so, people are doing basic research in actually giving people, healthy people, they are screened beforehand, so they have no other psychiatric comorbidity, to get them to induce, to get, give them psilocybin, LSD, ayahuasca, and then, for example, push them into the scanners and see how the brain reacts to these drugs and what we can learn from this in relation to altered states of consciousness.
So what, you give someone some mushrooms and put them in a machine and then get them to count seconds or guess how long a minute is?
No, well, what you can do is, first of all, you can, after so they say the impressions, the effect fades out slowly, you can give them questionnaires doing interviews. What did you experience?
Right.
And then you relate these experiences to what happened in the brain. And then you have basically, you could say, correlations of what's happening in the brain and what people report as their experiences.
If you gave LSD to someone and asked them to guess how long a minute was, would they be bad at that?
It depends. It depends on the dose, and also let's say dose dependence is probably the most important and what they actually experience. So they could, time could be very variable. For some, say minutes in objective time, it could expand totally, that they feel it is an ocean, a never-ending ocean time. Yeah, it's totally expanding. And then at other times, at peak experiences, they might say there is no time at all. And this is the most important, or the most interesting thing, that they say there is no time,
yeah,
or time has no meaning, which we actually in our ordinary day consciousness don't understand, because we're always thinking in time and having time experiences. But they say there is no time.
So why look at concept of time in these environments? Like what, I mean, not to be blunt, but what use is looking at time, for example?
Yeah, well, get it back to, let's say, more everyday, ordinary time consciousness. One understands it perhaps a little bit better, yeah, because everyone experiences it, yeah? And as I said, time consciousness and self-consciousness are very much related to each other.
Right.
So if you want to answer the question of what is consciousness, we also have to know what is time consciousness.
How are they related to each other?
Yeah, exactly. So an everyday experience. You're waiting for the bus, which is not coming. Yeah?
Yeah.
You're waiting and waiting. What happens? You're relating to yourself. You're experiencing yourself. That's a classic thing of boredom. Yeah? And what does it mean? You're experiencing yourself, your bodily self. Maybe you're cold, you're feeling bored, and time expands totally. But now imagine you're standing there at the bus stop, chatting with a good friend, and you're just chatting away the time. You're not even realizing that time is passing. You're not even realizing yourself, your bodily self. So again, there you see time and self are both co-modulated with each other. So it either is totally you're totally self-aware and time passes very slowly, or you're not feeling yourself and there's no subjective time. So you see, even in ordinary waking consciousness, time and self fluctuate with each other. So studying how time is implemented in the brain will lead to the answer of how consciousness arises.
Okay, so going back then to our subject who says there is no time, Are they also saying there is no self?
Yes, exactly. So these are the correlations. So if you have people in peak experience, what they report is, I don't feel time, I don't feel myself, I don't feel a bodily self. And also the other one, this more mystical experience, I feel one with the world. So these are actually the three answers people regularly give, which are correlated. And you actually can even look at brain research. Recent brain research from my colleagues in Zurich have revealed that a certain area in the brain, the insular cortex, is some sort of deactivated or decoupled from the rest of the brain. And what the insular cortex does is basically it's about interception, about your bodily signals accumulating in the brain, and so that you feel yourself, you feel heat, pain, cold, a tickle, and so on. And with this, and I have shown that time perception is related to the insular cortex, so time perception could be really related to your bodily self activity. And now in LSD induced states, the insular is decoupled, deactivated from other activation. So this could show, okay, in these states, suddenly insular activity building up the representation of body self and time isn't integrated into all the other processes. So there is maybe there is the answer of why we don't feel time and a self. So this is a good example of how this research with altered states of consciousness on self-consciousness, body feelings, and time consciousness tell us about the processes underlying consciousness. And so we are more step by step coming closer to answers, real answers to what how consciousness arises.
So if someone is suffering a mental condition, perhaps they are depressed or they don't feel themselves, so there's some conditions where people feel that their body isn't there, for example, body integrity disorder. There are lots of different types of conditions where people don't feel who they are, whether it's through sadness or through something slightly more unusual. Is there a route to therapy for these people, you think, in some way through LSD or mushrooms to sort of synchronize time in their present state?
Yeah, so this is all starting now in different locations in the US, in
really?
Barcelona, in Switzerland, in England, so that you have for certain psychiatric disorders, people are giving in a psychiatric, psychotherapeutic context, psychedelics. Because it's at the moment they're doing this with, for example, a patient with depression, where other means, psychopharmacological inductions or psychotherapy or meditation, haven't worked. And then actually the psychiatrists are allowed in these special patients to give psychedelics, but in the safe context of the hospital. And what they're showing is indeed very strong effects that the symptoms of depression go down, very strongly go down. And also another line of research is with terminal ill patients who fear anxiety, death anxiety, and are depressed. Again, with these in this psychotherapeutic context, through giving them psychedelics, also their death anxiety goes down. So which could be related to this idea that if you feel more connected to the world, one with the world, also your well-being goes up. And this is then counter-inducing all the depressive and anxiety symptoms.
That's good to hear. That is sort of brought into it. Mark Whitman, author of Altered States of Consciousness, Experience Out of Time and Self. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.